on April 12th, 19th. To repeat, this is a YUN interview with Ambassador Ernest Gross in his apartment in New York on April the 12th, 1990.
UN checklist I read.
All right. Ambassador Gross, I'm very grateful for you for having agreed to participate in this project. I would like to begin our session this morning, which will be related to Korea and the Korean War, by asking you, just for the record, to describe exactly what your position was in the U.S. government at the time of the aggression in Korea.
I'm very glad to be with you, Jim. I was appointed by President Truman to the U.S. mission to the UN as the deputy representative with the rank of ambassador and the general authority to represent the United States in all the agencies of the UN. That was under a legislation that had recently been enacted setting up that position, which hadn't existed before. I arrived in New York at the mission in October of 1949 and engaged immediately in some of the current then pending activities, Kashmir and other hotspots. And then in June of 1950, of course, the biggest of all, which was the Korean invasion across the 38th parallel from the north.
Could I just ask in that connection, there had been some incursions from the north by North Korean irregulars, I believe. Did the aggression, the full-scale invasion, come as a major surprise to you and to the U.S. government?
It came as a total surprise in the sense that, the reason I qualify it is that there had been warnings, just as you mentioned, of some activities and some concentrations of the troops, as quote, North Korean forces north of the 38th parallel, and that's really why the UN Commission was there and was able to report what was happening. It was there as a precautionary matter in order to report immediately, which they did, and which made it possible. We'll get to that, I'm sure, made it more likely that we would not have any real trouble in getting through a resolution.
Right, right. Now, at the time in June of 1950, who were the major players on the American side, and for that matter also on the UN side, who were involved in dealing with and handling the Korean crisis?
On the that night of June 25th, or to June 24th, I get confused on the time differential.
Right.
I got the call from the State Department at midnight, I think it was. At that time, the principal actors in Washington, the president was out of town, were, of course, the Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, Jack Hickerson, who was had charge of the International Organizations Affairs Office, the UN office, Dean Rusk, who was Assistant Secretary on the Far Eastern Division Affairs, and a couple of his assistants, at least two very active members of Hickerson's staff, one of whom was David Wainhouse, on the U.S. missions front. Ambassador Austin, who was my revered chief, was at his home in Vermont. So I was as in charge of the mission at that point, and my chief assistants were John Ross, Charles Noyes, James Hyde, who was legal advisor to the tour mission, and our very important director of public information, Porter McKeever. And we, and John, and John McVeigh. I think Porter McKeever came later. John McVeigh. Those were the principal actors.
And on the UN side, on the Secretariat side, there was, of course, the Secretary General.
Excuse me.
There was, of course, the Secretary General, first of all.
Oh, naturally. Yeah. Abe Feller, who was the brilliant legal advisor of the UN, very brilliant, upon whom Trigvi Lee depended heavily, and Ralph Bunch, Andy Cordier, Andrew Cordier. They were the principal figures working with Trigvi Lee.
And your initial contact has been charge of the U.S. mission, was with the Secretary General direct?
Yes, I telephoned him. I think about 3 in the morning, something like that, to report that we'd had this information. I found that Hickerson, because I was at a dinner, Hickerson had already called him to advise him.
Hickerson had been in direct touch with with the Secretary General, so he knew.
Yes.
And what was the Secretary General's attitude at this point?
Well, he responded at once with me, as Jack Hickerson later told me he had said the same thing to him. He said that this is, in effect, my God, this is war against the United Nations. And he used almost those exact words to me in the phone, and I take it he also said something very similar to Hickerson. So it was at once a spontaneous, strong reaction. There was no persuasion on our part.
In his memoirs, Trigvi Lee has suggested that, in his view, if the aggression in Korea was not met, it would mean the end of the United Nations, as the League of Nations had failed.
Yes, exactly so. And that was clearly his view. And it was the implication of his spontaneous remark when he had the news, and then repeated it when I called a couple of hours later.
When do you think...
Incidentally, may I just add...
Yes.
A lot of us felt the same way.
Right. Well, let me just ask in that connection, were there any differences on the American side in this respect?
Not that I was aware of at all. Quite the contrary. I don't know. Some of us, like myself, being older than I should have been, had to remember the League of Nations experience. I was studying in Geneva during the League days. And I remember very well the consequences, among other causes, of the demise of the League because of the failure to act with respect to Italian aggression against Ethiopia and the appeal of the emperor, Haile Selassie.
Right.
Those things are very much in some of our minds, actually.
Because the time, not so many years, had elapsed.
Not so many years had elapsed, actually.
There were still...
I mean, well within a person's lifetime.
Right. And Trigvi Lee, no doubt, had still in mind the memory of Emperor Haile Selassie, as you say, appealing to the League.
Very possibly, although I don't remember having said that, but it certainly was in my mind for one.
Now, after the invasion, there were a series of resolutions that were actually adopted quite quickly by the Security Council without too much difficulty.
Except as to wording.
As to wording?
Yes.
Well, could you describe a little bit of the difficulties with regard to wording?
Well, it centered on our original draft, which we worked out with the department, actually. Was softened in the sense that it did not describe the North Korean act as an invasion or an aggression. So that was the difference. I think there was the reason for that. Not that there were doubts on the part of the members of the council who attended a private session that took place during an intermission of the Security Council session that day. And I asked, may I back up a moment?
Certainly.
There? I had known from telephone conversations with virtually all members of the Security Council, whom I started to call about 1 a.m. that night, that we were going to ask the Secretary General to convene a session of the Council the next day, June 25th, at 2 p.m., I think it was, and that what we had proposed to do. Several of them, they responded, without any exception that I recall, by expressing shock and dismay, not in the same terms that Trigvi Lee had, but nonetheless, it was obvious, and some of them obviously had been awakened, so that it was really not a very studied reaction, but a spontaneous, emotional one, and therefore very true, some of them would have difficulty getting instructions. Indian, Yugoslav, Egyptian, there were others. Therefore, their main problem, on the hand, was to do what every diplomat hates to do, which is to make a decision like that at that moment without instructions. That made me a little apprehensive. I say made us. I'm speaking for nobody but myself, but I think I was certainly not the only one on the mission who felt that way. Apprehensive about, because we didn't really want to have a delay on a resolution. It was really a question of my having some leeway. Because nobody was up there to give me instructions, or for myself. I mean, I had to do things without instructions at the moment. But when we started the meeting, and fortunately, it struck me that it would be a good idea to invite the Republic of Korea representative, who was sitting in the back of the council chamber, and noticed that. I think he should be invited to the table. So. Of course, Malik wasn't there, the Soviets weren't there, so the chairman invited, no objection from the members of the council. That turned out to be very important, more important than I realized at the time. Trigvi Lee opened it with a speech condemning the aggression, and that's in the record. I followed with a speech condemning the aggression, invasion, tabled a resolution, as they say in UN parlance. Really, before it was discussed at any length at all, I realized that this was not the way to handle that tactically. So rather spontaneously, I suggested there's no way to communicate with Washington at that point. Although David Wainhouse, whom I had known at Oxford 20 years or more before, 20 odd years before, when we were old friends, gave me solace and comfort and strength, and he died some years ago, but he was a great, great scholar and a wonderful person. I turned to him and I said, Dave, what do you think? I think we perhaps should pick this up in an executive session of the council so that people can speak their piece without too much of a show of disunity or doubt. He shook his head, yeah, it's a good idea. So I moved to the recess, and we moved upstairs to a private room where we hammered out the few changes that were necessary. And the only the only problem was the Yugoslav, because the Yugoslav representative was there out of contact in the woods somewhere in the mountains. So his deputy was really at a loss. And he said the only thing he could do, he didn't dare vote yes, he didn't dare vote no. So he was the only abstention.
He was the only abstention, yeah.
That was why that happened. I think that had the Yugoslav representative been there, I don't know, but he wouldn't have had that same problem.
Right.
So anyway, that was it. So that was the resolution. Then we agreed in the closed session, came back, and there were a few speeches, and then it was adopted, approved. Then I reported immediately to Washington.
You mentioned the South Korean or the ROK representative, yeah. And this leads to a question that I wanted to ask. In reading through the various memoirs of the period, there are very few references to consultation with the South Korean government or the South Korean representatives. Was this true in New York?
No, I saw him. Oh, excuse me.
Go ahead.
Well, John M. Chang was his name, and we became very good friends, and I saw him a great deal and kept him advised as to what was going on. And he was very much in the confidence of the ROK, the Republic of Korea government. Later, he became vice president of
right.
Korea. And so that was the channel.
That was the channel. So the channel,
as far as I know, the only channel, although our ambassador in Korea might well, probably was talking with the president of the Republic of Korea, Syngman Rhee.
Yeah. And that was John Mucho. But I think that there was some sense in Washington that Syngman Rhee was a problem.
Well, we never trusted Syngman Rhee.
Right.
He was an authoritarian, dictatorial, irresponsible type, we all felt.
Now, did that make your task more difficult in New York in terms of the United Nations?
No.
It did not?
I don't think so. No. Later it became made difficult when he started to, when he did things in Korea during hostilities.
Now, you have mentioned the main characters in Washington and in New York. Could you describe a little bit the nature of the channel between Washington and New York? Sometimes, in later years, it's been suggested that the U.S. mission was somewhat isolated from Washington.
Excuse me, may I interrupt you?
Yeah.
When you say later years, I'm not sure what you
mean. After, long after Korea, after...
Oh, I see.
More,
I didn't know what you meant, yes.
No, more in the
right.
60s and
I see.
In the 70s.
Well, that was after my time.
Right.
Yes.
But I did want to ask whether this was true in at the time of Korea, whether the channels were totally open, and whether there was full coordination between Washington and the mission.
At the first point, yes, they were totally open. I mean, I think I must have been on the telephone 3-4 times a day. The file of cables back and forth were enormous. The channels were wide open, and I can't imagine a better group to deal with, more collegial, mutually respectful. Senator Austin, who must not be forgotten, his presence was very important. He, and also on another aspect, his presence was important because of the respect in which he was held on the Hill, where he'd been a distinguished senator. Therefore, although he was ill from time to time, as a result, I was found myself acting in chief. Nonetheless, I wouldn't discount his authority or his or the importance of his wise counsel, steady purpose, wonderful character. Now, I mention that because the spirit at the mission was the spirit he instilled, not me. And it was very, very important to have that figure and that influence. In Washington, needless to say, Acheson was, and Truman was, highly respected, to put it mildly. Dean Rusk had been an old friend from the Pentagon days when I was in the Army, and we worked together when I was in the Civil Affairs Division. He was in the Plans and Operations of the War Department. we were very good friends then, and always after that. And also Hickerson, with whom I had worked when I was in the department before going to the UN. You see, I was Assistant Secretary of State for Congressional Relations, so I had a license to roam the department.
Right.
And if I didn't get to know everybody at the top, then it was my fault, not theirs, you see. And so that was why I respected very much the people with whom we were dealing. I thought that the coordination and collegiality was first rate.
Was first rate.
Yeah.
Let me go to a slightly different
section. Excuse me.
Yeah. So to continue, I wanted to go to the question of the relations, if any, with the Soviet Union at this time. The Soviets were not in the Security Council, but I believe that the United States did, in fact, send a note to the Soviet Union very quickly after the outbreak of war, asking for Soviet assistance in ending the fighting. My question really is, in the absence of the Soviet Union in the Security Council, did you here, nonetheless, have contacts with the Soviet representatives with regard to Korea?
Contact was a good way to put it, a constant. Whenever we found ourselves at a dinner or a reception, at a dinner, the hostess would always seat us next to each other. You know, when we met at a cocktail party, we were expected to kind of talk. So it was really, the atmosphere was a bit strained in that sense. But the fact was that Ambassador Malik and I got along very well, personally. He was a genial fellow, maybe not to his own staff, I don't know, but certainly in our relationships, and I'm sure his relationships with others. And we talked about Korea a lot, but it was always the same strain of, why did you Americans invade North Korea? And that was a line, and that was what he expounded. And so I didn't feel that that was any future in that, but nonetheless we maintained a warm, in that sense, a warm, if not affectionate, at least a warm, cordial atmosphere between us. Sometimes I think that stood us in good stead, because there were straws in the wind occasionally. I really, just jumps ahead of the story, but I really felt at one point that I didn't predict that tail end of that radio speech in which you suggested a ceasefire and all of that thing. But I reported to the department at one point, I think by phone actually, that I had talked with him the night before, and I said, don't be surprised if they make a move.
And this is Ambassador Malik you're speaking
of. Ambassador Malik.
Right.
So it was, I felt that it was, payoff is too strong a word. It was the thing to do anyway. I mean, I was there not to vet my own personal feelings on anybody. So there was a relationship, and the cables reports to the department time after time after time reported my conversations with Malik and some of his people, the Zinchenko and other Russians who came. Gromyko would come, but he was impossible to talk to. He was very, very curt, and I think he also felt that my lack of authority was such that it wasn't worthwhile talking seriously with me in any event.
Now, you mentioned Zinchenko, and Zinchenko at that point, I believe, was the Assistant Secretary General for Security Council Affairs.
Yes, he was, indeed.
Did that pose a problem, having a Russian as the Assistant Secretary
General?
Well,
that's one reason I mentioned Zinchenko. I felt that there was a, shall we say, conflict of interest between the article of the Charter that calls for, rather merely suggests, an effective international civil service in terms of loyalty to the organization, not at the expense of those nationality, but in the sense of maintaining the integrity of your position. And I felt that that in talking, I felt a little strange talking with him, because frequently it was with Malik alongside.
But even while the Soviets were not participating in the Security Council,
yes.
Zinchenko was no doubt there, because as the assistant.
Oh, yes. Well, we would meet. A couple of reports I looked at, just to refresh my recollection before this.
There we go. Go ahead.
Is that?
We have two more minutes.
that a conversation which at dinner where we went off to a table in the restaurant, in the hotel, Zinchenko, Malik, and myself, the three of us talked at great length, and I reported that.
We'll stop here.
Sounds more like gossip than anything else.
Well, in a sense.